tell you.
The meeting will come to order.
No.
May I have it? The meeting will come to order. May I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Faust moves approval of the minutes of January 31st. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. We have a hearing today on PS Minnesota. And many of us had a chance to go to a large meeting that they had in, I think it was Bloomington, last year. And there was actually one in my city of Roseville. And we've heard a lot about this large proposal from our constituents and others. And so now we're going to have a formal presentation in the House committee, and I'm guessing that you will probably tell us the current status of the proposal as well. I think I have you down in the order that you're talking, but you can correct me if it's different. But we have Greg Vandell, who is with PS Minnesota, but also superintendent of District 47, and I'm sure you'll introduce yourself a little more. Brad Lundell, who's with Schools for Equity and Education. Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and Scott Grunquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Mr. Vandell, are you going to start?
Yes, I am, Chair Breiling. Thank you so much for inviting us here today. And we do, in fact, have some preliminaries that are typically covered by the three members of the executive committee for PS Minnesota, and one of them is in absentia, so we're going to just make it up along the way. Scott Grunquist, the executive director for the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, as you know, has many responsibilities at the Capitol and no doubt will join us as soon as he can. It is our pleasure to have an opportunity to spend time before this committee to talk about an initiative that I know many of you have heard of over the past several months. While the chair described what we're about to do is to make a formal presentation, I would suggest it will be only as formal as you would choose. It is my hope that this can be as interactive as possible along the way. But we do have prepared remarks and we do have a PowerPoint presentation that we can walk through as we outline what we believe to be some fundamentals of a good school funding formula. We would invite your commentary all along the way. We recognize that this is an issue of critical importance in the state of Minnesota, and we recognize that some of what we are suggesting to you is a dramatic reform initiative, something that really hasn't been undertaken in the state since perhaps the 1970s. With that in mind, what I would like to do is to provide a bit of a preliminary by way of the individuals who, as I suggested earlier, serve in leadership for this coalition that we call PS Minnesota. We have, in the past, typically had... Oh, go ahead. The ghost of school funding present has just arrived. We've typically had the three executive directors provide a past, present, and future perspective for what PS Minnesota is and what it's all about. And then I have spent some time walking through a framework for a funding solution that we would ask that you consider. And now that we have Scott on board, I think we'll just turn right to that format. So, Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity.
Mr. Lundell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. I've got double duty today because we are missing Rick Dressen, who the DINA superintendent, who was chairman of the governor's task force. And that's really where our story begins, is with the task force appointed by Governor Plenty in 2003. Coming out of the 2003 session, there was a provision in that bill which created a 19-member task force to talk about simplifying education funding in Minnesota, kind of looking at education funding from a variety of new angles and are our formulas working and were they simple and were they adequate and equitable. That task force met throughout the fall of 2003 and into the early parts of 2004 and released its final report in July of 2004. One of the big disappointments that we had, let me just say that was a tremendous effort by 19 very talented people, But we felt that that report didn't go far enough in defining what we believed would, you know, the details needed to redesign the education funding formula. And what it really came up, where it really came up short, is that it didn't really give us any idea as to whether or not the resource level being put forward by the state was sufficient to meet the really the needs of a 21st century school system. And so we, after that report came out in July of 2004, Schools for Equity in Education enlisted John Myers. And just by some, you know, for you to know about who John Myers is, if you just, you know, you Google John Myers and education finance, and you're going to get about 100 pages of studies and all kinds of things that John has done across a broad range of education funding issues. He's been very active in community education, charter schools, and as much as anything else, adequacy funding, both with, you know, or again, over the past 25 years. He's a former legislator, formerly worked with the Education Commission of the States and the National Conference of State Legislators. In that work, the one thing that John said that came out of his very brief analysis of the governor's task force is that they really needed to go further with much deeper levels of analysis. And with that, then, Schools for Equity, we reached out to our partners in the Minnesota Rural Education Association and the Association of Metropolitan School Districts and enlisted Myers once again to take a look at the governor's methodologies and to go deeper given the governor's framework. Where would you go next? And we took the professional judgment panels, which was one of the ways, Greg will be talking a little bit about that, one of the methodologies for use in determining whether or not the levels of funding are adequate to meet state and local, state and federal standards. That report was released in December of 2005, and the report showed that we were $952 million below the resource level needed to deliver state and federal standards in the state of Minnesota. We had only used one methodology in that report, however, and that we wanted to go again even further to vet those findings against some other methodologies as well. So we once again enlisted John Myers to look at those results through three other methodologies, and again, Greg will be talking a little bit about those methodologies. But when we come out of these methodologies, we released those in December of 2006. That shows show that we are, you know, in the ballpark when we're talking about being $1 billion short. So with that, I'll turn it over to Scott Twinquist to talk about what the current exercises we are undertaking.
Mr. Twinquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Kornquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. I represent 30 school districts in the 7-county metropolitan area. As Mr. Lundell said, we've been very busy the last couple of years working on this initiative. And I think you have a handout in your packet that looks like this. And on the reverse side of that is a list of all the partners that are now involved in the PS Minnesota effort. And as you
Actually, we have these two, but not one that looks like what you're holding up. You have it. Some of us have it. Anyway, it looks like I've got it now. Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that, man. On the reverse side of that is a list of all of the organizations that are currently involved and are partners in the effort. And so you can see how this has grown over time, and the number of parties that are keenly interested in this topic. And we think it really results from just a deep frustration across the state with the current education funding system and the desire of people to reform it and to modernize it and to really bring it into a new era. And so we've been working on that over the last years. Once we got the results from the John Myers study that Brad referenced, and we've had a couple of different efforts going forward on a parallel basis. One was a committee that we originally deemed the Solutions Committee that was charged with trying to come up with a new funding framework and specific formula recommendations. And that involved a whole host of people, people with a lot of experience in education finance, business managers, superintendents, special education directors, all involved trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And then we've also had a communications effort trying to educate the general public and others about this initiative. And springing forward from that has been a website, and if you haven't had a chance to check it out, it's psminnesota.org, and there's a wealth of information available there, giving you background information about the different partners. The full study, the John Meyer study that Brad referenced, is available there, as well as an executive summary of that report, and a lot of other information. And so that brings us up to, I think, where we are now, and my other colleague here, Sam Walseth, is going to take it from there.
All right. Mr. Walseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I have the fun job of talking about the future of this effort, and while I'd like to look into my crystal ball and be able to predict that by May 21st we will have a fully funded, adequate education bill passed into law, that effort is largely in your hands. And the future of this initiative is largely in the ability and the willpower of the legislature and the public to embrace what is now a public mandate that we no longer have a system of schools, of universal access to our schools. We move to a system and an expectation of universal achievement. All of our students, by 2013, 2014, all of our students are required to be 100% proficient on our state standards. We have expectations for ELL kids to be proficient, special ed kids to meet all of their potential. If we're going to do that, we have to have a serious talk about adequacy in our funding system and education here in Minnesota. It's not easy to stand here today and talk about being $1 billion short on an annual basis, but if we're going to be serious about talking about all the programs we want for gifted and talented kids, for special education, for regular education, we need to have a serious conversation about adequacy. So the future of this effort really lies in the willpower of the public and this committee and the legislature at large to really embrace the research that has been done by our professional judgment panels in Minnesota and to move forward in that effort. With that, I think I'll turn over to Mr. Vondell.
Mr. Vondell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it really is my pleasure to sit before you and to spend some time talking about what we think is an important and an exciting concept. I serve as the superintendent of schools for Sauk Rapids Rice. Sauk Rapids Rice is a system of about 3,800 students. It's growing. It's in central Minnesota, hugging right up next to St. Cloud. That's my real job, but I have to suggest I have a passion that's developed over the course of some time. In the 90s, I did doctoral work at the University of Minnesota, and the focus of my studies was education funding equity. And in fact, my involvement initially in this enterprise was through the Schools for Equity in Education, where I serve as an executive board member. In fact, I sit as a school district that is a property poor and is one of a very few in the state of Minnesota that does not currently have an operating referendum in place. I have several presentations on here, and it would have been coy of me to place the other presentation in front of you, because I've got the presentation we made to our Board of Education a week and a half ago on how we're going to reconcile a $1.5 million budget shortfall. And it lists almost every expenditure category in our school district as we're examining what needs to be reduced from that. That's not what our presentation is about, but I have to suggest to you that the reality is, because we do not have a system of adequacy in the state of Minnesota, and because we rely on an operating referendum to deliver basic services, those districts, especially without operating referenda, find themselves at a disadvantage. But we are not the only districts in distress. I found it ironic, and I closed comments in the Senate counterpart last week with the bill they were examining on that Wednesday. As a matter of fact, as I saw the press cycle yesterday, it was the first bill that actually has been signed into law this legislative session. And it's a bill which extends tax credits to educators who go into their own pockets to pay for instructional materials. And I had to suggest I commended the committee on a reform initiative. And I asked them if they'd done the examination of the other professions to see if they were going to extend this tax credit to surgeons who bring their own surgical instruments into the operating room, and to lawyers who bring their own legal briefs into the courtroom, and to auto mechanics who bring carburetors from home so they can replace them for clients' automobiles at work. And there were some smiles around the room, just as there are today. But the reality is that's a measure of sufficiency in the state of Minnesota. The fact that we are responsible for an enterprise that is funded in such a fashion so that the folks that are hired to deliver instructional services need to supplement that instruction by going into their own pockets. Certainly, by almost any measure, we don't have a state of sufficiency. What we are doing today is we're going to review a program that is perhaps an answer to the standard question, so how much is enough? And I've gotten that question here before, not perhaps in this room, but certainly before the Senate committee before. So tell us, Mr. Superintendent, how much is enough? And I've had a difficult time answering that question in the past. Today we can tell you how much is enough because we're using a methodology, a scientific research base, which can, with some certainty, suggest to you what is required in order to fund public education. As we walk through this presentation today, you'll note that I've got a handout which shows my PowerPoint, and you get a sense for how long this guy's going to go on and on and on. But as I suggested early on, please know that this is not intended to be presentation. It's intended to be exchange. Very early in my career, I contemplated the prospect I was in seminary, as a matter of fact. I thought of a different calling in my life. So I can put a little bit of that passionate zeal, a little bit of religious fervor into this, but that really isn't my intention in this audience. My intention instead is to inform. So please know that if there's something you need from me or from any of us along the way, that you jump in. Let's start with a framework for what we believe to be a good funding formula. It's based on a central premise that good school funding is rationally linked to student needs, it's based on research, and it's supported by data. What you're going to be seeing today, in fact, meets those three measures. Student needs are considered, especially from the perspective of the state now has standards in place. It's part of the reason why a dozen years ago I may not have been able to answer the question, how much is enough, particularly well. We know today what we're expected to deliver. I sat with principals last week at the MASSP conference and made essentially the same presentation. Talked to them about how when I was a high school principal, what was I expected to deliver? I can tell you what I was expected to deliver. 4 years of English and 4 years of social studies and 3 years of math and 3 years of science. And that was the standard. And it's not a standard. It's a seat time requirement. Today we know that there are proficiency standards out there. We can measure them. We know what student needs are. We can then, from a research perspective, take a look at the cost of delivering those needs. And in fact, that research gets inside the data that exists not only in this state, but all across this nation. And Brad Lundell talked a little bit about some different methodologies. In fact, I'm not here to give you my dissertation on how to do an adequacy study, but I would suggest to you that there's a pretty solid research base that is behind much of this. So if you take a look at that as the central premise for a framework, what characteristics might you use to measure a good system of funding? This really comes from some national research. Understand that a good system does target student achievement. It's designed so that funding that goes into the system produces an outcome we call learning or achievement. We know that a good funding system is sensitive to property wealth differentials. I mentioned I'm a property poor school district, and there are other districts across the state that have considerably greater property wealth. We've essentially accepted this kind of egalitarian principle from time to time in the state of Minnesota. Sometimes it feels more fair than others, but we do know that a good funding system has property wealth sensitivity. We know that it accounts for differences in students and districts. As a matter of fact, when I do this as a presentation in front of an audience, I talk about a couple of kids and a couple of school districts, and it's pretty important for us to understand that we know that kids are kids, but there are also kids. We have those every day. I mean, most kids are like one another in some ways, but there are children that are distinctly different from one another. I would make the same claim that districts are districts, and then there are districts. And we can get into some of those differences as we move forward. Because under the current system of funding in the state of Minnesota, as a matter of fact, in many places across this nation, there aren't really rational distinctions made between kids or districts as funding streams are assembled. We're suggesting that good systems account for those differences. We also will argue that good systems permit local discretion. But you're going to hear throughout our comments today a move away from operating referenda as the way to run the basic program of the schools. I use the word operating referendum, and it actually is, you go to Superintendent 101 class, and they say never use the word excess levy. even though I believe excess is the word in the statute. Talk about operating referenda, because if you talk excess, the voters are going to say, well, why would I vote for extra? In fact, that was the intention of that operating referendum early on, to provide for excess kinds of programming, extra services. Today, it provides for operations. And what we're suggesting is if there's going to be discretion, it needs to be for extras, not for operations. We also would suggest that a good funding formula provides resources that are specifically designed to meet capital obligations. Also, that would provide equal access, equalized access to construction. And I would say, finally, what we're hoping, this isn't finally, but what this is also predicated on is that the funding is sufficient to meet the needs that the state lays before us, the requirements the state lays before us. And finally, if you're going to measure a funding system, you would suggest that that funding system, if it's a good one, if it's sustainable, if it's predictable, if it's sufficient, is based on an equalized blend of resources. I'm going to pause for a second and just ask if anybody's got questions on any of the characteristics or our simple premise.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Vandell. It's good to see you again.
Nice to see you as well.
As I look at the critical characteristics, and I've been here for a few years, and I think I know part of the answer to this, but it seems to me that we've talked about all these things here as policymakers, and we've made all sorts of efforts at bits and pieces of this. Can you give us a grade or a score on how we're doing on these critical characteristics? Are there any of these that we've totally missed the boat? I know I'm kind of jumping a little bit ahead here on things we'll be talking about, but you know, I'm sure my colleagues are sitting here thinking, well, this makes sense. Isn't this what we're doing in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Vandell.
Madam Chair and Representative, I would suggest to you that you are attempting to make progress on many of these. And this is just one superintendent's read. I would suggest that the one that you are least successful with currently is providing the sufficient base, because we are entirely reliant on operating referenda in the state of Minnesota to operate the basic program of the school. The differential is $1,700 or $1,800 a student. Using Sauk Rapids Rice as that example, if we were merely funded at the average funding across the state of Minnesota, and by the way, we're not advocating for just averages, everybody comes back to one mushy center. But if we were funded at the average, we would have $600 a student more to operate. We're cutting $1.5 million out of our program. $600 a student more is $2.5 million. So the problem my board would have had to address this last Monday night was, how do I infuse $1 million into my operation as opposed to reduce $1.5 million? That would be one I would suggest. The other I would suggest is that our system is not targeted toward achievement. We expect achievement, but it isn't predicated on achievement. What it is it's predicated on available resources. Why is the funding formula at approximately $5,000 a student today? And the answer is because that's what was available as a resource. Not because that's what any science said to you it costs to educate a student in accordance with today's standards, but because that's what it is. It's a 4% increase from what it was the biennium before, and maybe a 2% or a 1% from the biennium before. It's not predicated on what the research would suggest. That would be the answer I would provide.
Thank you.
Representative Heidkirchen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's always good to see you, Mr. Vandell, and I think we visited over the last number of years and all many times, and likewise the whole group up in front. It's always good seeing you, and I know we had a lot of discussions last year and the year before, and we went through the final last bill that we did finish up. But listening to your analysis, you're missing a key component. And it's one of the components Representative Mariani, we discussed at length the achievement gap and some of the factors creating the achievement gap. You failed, and I agree with you, and I visit with the former governor, Wendy Anderson, over the Minnesota Miracle that you referred to earlier back in the 70s. But times have changed since then as well, and we've added categoricals among other things. But the key thing that you're missing, whenever we compare Minnesota and what Minnesota has gone in comparison to other states, we don't acknowledge mobility. Students on the move. You can take individual school districts, and you can point a finger at St. Paul. And why is St. Paul falling behind some other school districts? They have a problem with mobility. If we compare with the nation, globally, we've had committee meetings on that. How we compare, well, why is Norway number one? Or why is China doing very well in certain areas? Again, countries that do not have a large population on the move tend to do better. And I think that's one issue. I think that's one, even with our testing, that we need to do, we have to reanalyze how we evaluate results. We need to give time for assimilation. And I think that's a component that oftentimes is forgotten, even when you compare, I got 13 school districts. And one will have different problems than others. But I'm just saying, that's an issue that needs to be looked at also when you come up with a funding mechanism.
Mr. Van Dell.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidegger, and I would not disagree with anything you suggested. And I'm going to ask those of you who are interested, if you want to skim ahead, there is one other handout we've given you. It's a framework for New Minnesota Education Funding Formula. And we do talk at one point in time, I'll get to that, about adjustments that need to be made for student differences. And we've had lengthy conversations internal to PS Minnesota about the very issue of mobility. This is a concept, not a construct, meaning we're talking about just general principles here. But as we drill down to the construct itself, without a doubt, those kinds of issues need to be addressed. Anybody else? Okay. Let me do this.
Excuse me. One more question. You asked for questions as you went along, so you're going to get them. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vadda, what is the current, I know you got a 2003 spending rank, or we're ranked 28th. Do you know what the current ranking is?
Mr. Van Dell.
Madam Chair, Representative, I have seen, I won't say research, I would say references in some of the Ganyu Kodrowski work to our slipping from 28th to 37th. I'm not certain where they got that data rank, but I will suggest to you that the direction is down, not up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding that particular piece of information, I'm curious about the relevance of that. We have more dollars going in terms of dollars. I understand the deflated value. It shows it's actually going down. A higher percentage of our state's total budget is going to education all the time. We've increased it from mid to upper 30s to now we're 40% of our total state budget going to education. And yet we hear about less of our income percentage going toward education. Can you explain to me the relevance of that?
Mr. Van Dell.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, I'm not here to debate whether 28% is right or whether 52% is right. When we move into our framework, what we're going to try to suggest to you is whatever percentage the state ultimately chooses to fund is tied to what the state expects us to achieve. We really are trying to change the mindset from dollar invested to some glossy and kind of nebulous idea of what it is we wish to accomplish, back to we know precisely what we wish to accomplish, and let's now take a rational examination of the costs associated with that achievement. And frankly, our rank simply suggests that in terms of our relative connection to other states, we have been more sufficiently funded, we have been less sufficiently funded. What we'd like to do is to drill into what is sufficiency and move forward from there.
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you. And I would submit also that for more relevance to that, we'd also have to know what our income as a state has been relative to the other states that you're comparing to. It's also possible that our income has gone up to a greater extent that wouldn't cause our percentage of spending to go down, even though it may be on par. I'm just suggesting that when we use these statistics, let's be certain that we're in, knowing what the relevance is and what real meaning is that it has. Yeah.
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, is this ranking, is that a percentage or actual dollar amount?
Mr. Van Dell.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, that data element actually emerged through some research done out of the research branch of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and it does take into account an income relative to other incomes across the nation and the measure of spending as associated with that income. But again, if we were engaging in a debate, I would say I'm insufficiently armed because I didn't come researching that particular element. My area of information today really is relative to the formula itself, as opposed to the data elements on the background sheet, which was actually developed by another branch of our PS Minnesota initiative.
Okay, we're at the end of the questions for now, so proceed.
Great. Let's jump in. A basic formula framework. I need to suggest to you a couple of things as you move forward. Many of you have been around this capital for a long, long time, have been on this committee for many sessions. Some of what we're going to be talking about today might sound familiar. In fact, we're not suggesting that in a reform initiative, everything that's currently being done must be abandoned wholesale and everything new must be brought in instead. Matter of fact, if you think about school funding as a quilt covering the state of Minnesota, one could argue that in some places it might feel kind of sufficient, some places it might feel insufficient because it's threadbare. But what has happened is this quilt of school funding has essentially been cobbled together, sewn together over the course of time with not necessarily a pattern in mind. Representative Heidegger talked about the Minnesota miracle. I would suggest there was a pattern, good pattern, bad pattern. That's history has measured that in different ways. But nonetheless, it was a pattern. But what's happened since then is that pieces have been snipped away and other pieces have been added on. And all of those things have been done for good reason, but not necessarily with any rational link one to another. What we're suggesting we should do as we move forward is disassemble that quilt, take the pieces that make sense, that fit, and reassemble it in the sense of a pattern that makes sense, a pattern targeted to student achievement, a pattern that's supported by research, a pattern that there is a data element that can support it. What we do as we move forward then is we really suggest there are three different parts to our formula. The first is a student is a student and then there are students. A kid is a kid and then there are kids. That's the learner component. We'll talk a little bit about that in a second. And the second two really are a district is a district, except there are districts. We're going to first talk about those districts that are exceptional, that have special circumstances, and then really talk in that district support services component about how many districts have common characteristics that need to be addressed. If you take a look at the learner component, we would suggest to you that we move away from the convoluted analysis that's currently in place. Again, I reference the presentation I made to the high school principals just last week. I challenged the group, why is a high school student weighted at 1.3 as opposed to an elementary student weighted at 1.067, whatever the heck it is today? And the answer was, because it costs more to educate a high school student. Well, I was a high school principal, and I made that argument many times in my life, but frankly, the data doesn't support that. The reason it's 1.3 for high school students and 1 for elementary students is because if it wasn't 1.3, if you use the $5,000 number that you have as the foundation formula, schools go belly up. It's about the math. It's a multiplier. And if 5,000 were something more rationally linked to what it costs to deliver standards, then 1 could be the number. And we would suggest that for purposes of not just simplicity, but actually for purposes of reason, that our formula should be weighted at 1. We also are advocating what you've heard many times from many groups over the years, that if we're going to be attaining the standards, achieving what it is we're expected to achieve these days, we need an all-day kindergarten in place. The numbers that we bring forward have all-day kindergarten as a part of this. If I talk about a rational number, if students are weighted at 1 and base costs are rationally determined, our APA work would indicate that in 2004-05, the most recent year for which data was available, the foundation should have been set at $5,938 as opposed to the $5,000 that it is today. But recognize it's not just $5,938 times 1.3 times 1.067, it's $5,938 times the 1. If you'd move that, you know, by inflation or whatever numbers, it would be higher or lower. We're not here to talk today about whether $5,938 is the right number. It is the number that emerged from the research we commissioned. What we're here today to talk about is how it should be determined through research as opposed to simply a determination made based purely on available resources. If we talk about a kid as a kid, that is a 1, but then there are kids, those are the adjustments. We mentioned an adjustment for mobility a short time ago. That's certainly one at-risk factor. Other at-risk factors certainly exist. The most common at-risk proxy across the nation today is the free and reduced proxy. The research would suggest that if the formula is set at 5938 and you make appropriate adjustments for at-risk students, you would have an added value, so to speak, to that kid as a kid and then there are kids. The student who is at risk is weighted under this construct as 1.75. The student who is an ELL student, has a challenge with English language, would be weighted at 1.9. And frankly, if you've got a student that's at risk and is ELL, then one would argue that there should be some additional factor and perhaps not a full added value, but certainly an additive value as you move forward. What we're really talking about here is something that is not altogether unheard of in industry and business. My dad was a manufacturer, and he and I talked about production all of the time. It was his responsibility in a small jewel bearing plant. He was also responsible for quality control. This is called a production function approach to school finance. It's a production function approach in industry. My dad would produce a jewel bearing, and he would say, all right, what's the cost of the material that's required to design and create this product? What's the labor cost associated with it? What's the electricity? What are all of the other soft and hard costs associated with the production of this? He could put a price on production and actually could set prices in the marketplace as a result of that kind of an analysis. Where do these numbers come from? They really come from a production function approach to looking at the cost of education. The state and the feds have standards. And we can take a look using some research methodology at what it costs to meet those standards. These numbers all are driven off of those costs.
Mr. Vandell, how could you estimate how that 0.75 for at risk and the 0.90 for ELL compares to the current adjustments in our formula for those categories?
I'm actually going to turn to the folks at my table to see if they've got it. We did not do that estimate, Madam Chair, but I'm going to ask them anecdotally if you just have that sense.
Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there will be some dollars to be moving around because there's two things that happen here. Number one is the free and reduced are both a full student under this framework. We want to stress framework, not formula. So right now under current law, it's every student receiving free lunch is 1 and every student receiving reduced price lunch is 0.5. And that's how you get your sum, is the sum of those exercises. So you're going to see some redistribution based on the fact that the reduced price lunch is going to be more heavily weighted in this. We also do not have building concentration in this framework, and so there's going to be another set of kind of redistributions on that. And again, one of the things that was some folks who we've talked to said, well, you didn't come up with a formula. And I said, well, there's so many things here that are moving around. And Representative Heidkirchen brings up mobility, which is something that could easily be incorporated into this as well. And so what we need to find the proxies that most closely mimic learning, barriers to learning or barriers to achievement, and then have the formulas designed on whether it's free lunch, free and reduced, with different weightings, same weightings, mobility, non-English speaking. All these things are qualities that do create some challenges for districts. Does concentration fit in that, either on a district-wide level or on a building level? Those are questions I think we need to, you know, really kind of back up and kind of continually move around with. I think it takes far more, probably it's going to take far more analysis than we're able to do right now. And I guess that's kind of our entreaty to the legislature today. We've come to the point where the expertise that exists with the legislature, legislators, and legislative staff really is what we need to tap into now as we do our next set of modeling.
Well, and the reason I was asking is because obviously we do adjust for both of those factors in the current formula, and I'm wondering, just generally speaking, if you think we currently adjust too much or not enough. Are you adjusting more for these two factors or less than the current formula. And it sounds like it's more complicated than that with the compensatory, because it's, you average it out at 0.75, whereas currently we have 2 and 1.5 plus the concentration. But maybe ELL, is that one adjusting more or less for children who don't speak English compared to what we do right now?
Madam Chair, I would, members of the committee, I'm comfortable in saying that ELL is well in excess of what we're doing right now.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know where to begin, but when I'm looking at, you know, any time, I mean, we get a political landscape here, as you well know. I went through the battles with the governor's initiative a couple of years ago, and I think Representative Grant, remember that we talked about the changing of the weights and everything else. Everybody, first thing they do, every representative is going to do here, they're going to run their school districts, see how they come out on it. And then you've got, I mean, you've got people going back and forth, and it depends. I mean, just change weights. Seems like it's simple, but what about the schools that have charter schools, that have private schools, a high concentration of elementary school, and they're going to be shorted in comparison to what they're getting right now because they have preponderance of high school kids. But going over the list, for example, Mr. Lindell touched upon it. A lot of it is site-based and everything else. I think perhaps we could go back to the history of that and go back to where it used to be done at the county level. I think we look back in the early stages. I think back in Wendy Anderson's time. But what is the best way of doing it? Is it doing it taking the average income based on that way? Because there's a lot of abuse, and you're still going to have those abuses within the program, within administrations, counting people and having them fill out forms, and there's a lot of abuse. We can go on and on and on in that particular area. And in certain areas, students don't sign up for it because there's a sense of pride. My kids are not going to be on any free readers. But I'm just saying, there's a lot of things at play that still won't address the problem we're having with it right now, just with the at-risk.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Lundell,
there's a paper, and I can get you a copy of mm-hmm. it. It was featured in Education Week. It's been done within the last year. And they're in this whole, in the paper, and it has a lot of analysis that's way beyond my mathematical abilities. But I think the finding the right proxy for this is a challenge. Finding the right proxy to really show what are the challenges to learning, how do we get kids to standards, and how do we zero in. It's been my, in this, I speak now as kind of my opinion on things as opposed to anything that was here, but I think that what I've seen over the last few years, or last couple decades actually, is probably a moving away from the general ed amount toward more targeted categoricals, and we're doing more distribution of dollars for categoricals as opposed to the general ed. From my organizational standpoint, we would like the general ed higher and then use the categoricals to really zero in for those districts and those sets of students that really have unique needs, and I think it's our moral obligation to look at those districts and say, and not to make it political, and not to say, well, they're getting this or that or other thing. Rather than trying to make these categoricals do too much, we should make these categoricals do what they're intended to do, which is zero in on those students and groups of students that really have barriers to learn.
Representative Heidgerken.
Just to follow up, Representative Grattan, on your question. In regards to the ERL, and she had asked a question whether, and I think one of you had answered that it would more than cover it. I mean, is that taking into consideration the innovation aid, the LEP, all of those other best practices, all those other components, the categoricals? Would that?
Mr. Lundell. Or Mr. Vandell.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidegger, we in fact, you'll see an integration component as we move through this. And you've asked some excellent questions. I would suggest to you that we don't have all of the answers. I talked about concept versus construct today. Mr. Lundell says something real significant. He doesn't. It wasn't the first. The way you laughed, it was like it was a first.
Mark that.
we really are, what's the ask today? Usually you wait, you either give the ask at the beginning or at the end, but we'll just suggest the ask today is if you're intrigued enough by this that you continue to work with us to create a construct. In fact, we've begun to work with some of your legislative staff as well as in the Senate staff to try to see what happens. Representative Heidegger can mention, you know, we're in a day of kind of volatile politics, and people like to do what John Myers calls is to have what John Myers calls is down and right disease. Every time you get any construct for school funding, you take a look at what happened to me, and then you compare it to next door to see what happened.
Mm-hmm.
We're really not advocating a system that will show equality from place to place. We are really advocating a system that will show equality is measured, by the way, is exact same. We're measuring success based on whether it's rationally based on the condition of that student in that school district. Sartell is right next door to Sauk Rapids Rice, has almost the same number of students. What we're talking about right now is a system in which Sauk Rapids Rice might end up with 4,200 pupil units, and Sartell might have 4,700 pupil units. Why? Because Sartell might have a higher concentration of at-risk and a higher concentration of ELL. And that's a rational purpose, a rational reason for Sartell having more pupil units and, frankly, more resource than Sauk Rapids Rice, because they have a greater need. Remember our premise, tied to need. This is a need measure. Certainly it needs to be more sophisticated than this, but it's a need measure. And certainly we can't forget special education as one of those factors. I can't forget that. So we'll look at special ed a little bit more detail. We have in our coalition...
Excuse me just a minute. Before you go ahead, Mr. Strom passed me the answer to my first question, so I got to read it, the one about the at-risk adjustment, but I think I'll have him say it out loud just so all the committee members have benefit of that. But before he does, while he's doing it, if you change your mind and you don't think you're going to get done with your presentation, we could hold questions until you do finish. But I'm going to leave it up to you to tell me when we get to that point, because we're just spending today on it. We've got 45 more minutes, and I like to have the questions also, but we also want to get through your presentation. But Mr. Strom, if you would just say that answer out loud so everybody knows the answer to my question.
Madam Chair, as the presenters have said, a lot of things will move around, including the formula allowance and the relative concentration on the free versus the reduced. But currently, for our compensatory revenue, once you reach maximum concentration, you're essentially at 60% of the formula allowance. Mm-hmm. And so if this is going to 75%, that'd be a larger amount. And so right now at 60% of the current formula allowance, that's $2,984. And 75% of that same amount would be $3,730. So all districts, regardless of our current concentration formula, would gain more under that. Those with small concentrations would gain the greatest amount because each compensatory child would be weighted the same under that proposal.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vendell, I appreciate your comments that you just made about the equity not being defined as students being the same and the same because of students having different needs. And over the years, that's the comments that I've always heard, is that students have basically different needs. If I understand you correctly, that's really the same thing that you're saying today. It's about something that will identify those needs, and we will end up with different funding for students based on needs being different, circumstances being different, districts being different, and so forth. Is that correct?
Mr. Vendell.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, that is precisely what we're talking about. And not only are we talking about the funding being different, but we're talking about those differences being related to the true input costs of raising those children that are different to the standards. We're in an environment, it's not just a federal law that no child should be left behind. It is our mandate that we bring all children to standards, and we take that very seriously. What we would hope is that the funding system itself is predicated on a similar high standard, and that we are provided the resource that research would suggest is required to bring those kids to standards.
Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vendell, thank you very much for the follow-up comment. That's exactly what I was looking for, and I would like to reference getting together with you afterwards for some more information.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. based on these changes with the formula, I mean, do we know how much making each change would cost, or is it possible to get what making each of these formula changes might cost piece by piece? And is that what you're asking us to look at, how much each piece costs, or just in general taking everything out and then coming up with a larger dollar amount? Because at the end of the day, we're going to end up with a limited dollar amount. And while we all might want to, you know, fund each of these items at a certain percentage, we're going to end up with a set amount, and we're going to have to pick and choose. And I'm just curious as to how you're recommending we go about doing that. Mr. Vandell.
Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. We recognize that, you know, while I suggest that you've made decisions vested solely in available resource, I make decisions vested in available resource every day. I understand that. But what I would hope that would happen as you move forward, that you would begin to measure that forward progress against both the concepts that we've talked about and also against some of these fundamental principles. And I would hope that, you know, we're nearly through the learner component. Recognize that this quilt is woven together, and to simply make effort on the learner component to the exclusion of the other things would not be to put together a logical construct. So I'm hoping that all of this would receive some effort, while I do know that you will be taking measured steps forward based on both political will and available resource. I mentioned special education, Madam Chair, if I could continue forward.
Please.
There are some component parts to special ed. I don't sit here as a special education expert. I need to suggest that to you. But I will suggest to you that the way we fund special education today does not necessarily meet the test of logic. And if some believe that it does, I would be happy to spend time away from this chamber room to talk that through. Because I make an expenditure today in my organization for special education, and I have a promise that 2 years from now I might get that money back. And I get a promise that I'm going to get approximately 68% of what I spent today, but then that 68% is prorated, and currently is prorated at 79%. So I get 79% of 68% 2 years from now for a dollar that I spend today. I'm sorry, but I don't know very many businesses that operate in that fashion. We're supposed to operate like a business. Then if I have an expenditure requirement today, then I should have an expectation that that federal and state mandate come with the resource to meet that mandate. That essentially is a cost reimbursement model, and we used to have a cost reimbursement model in place in this state. We've departed a little bit from the APA research here, because the APA research would suggest that an easy way for purposes of analysis to take a look at special education is to weight special education students as you weight ELL students, as you weight at-risk students. And the recommendation in the Myers report was to weight at 1.0. Frankly, we don't consider that to be particularly rational or actually fiscally prudent, because within my organization, I have students on IEPs who are working on the letter R on a speech IEP. And I have students in my organization that require a 2-to-1, two staff members for one student, because of their incredibly high needs. And weighting both of those students at one does not seem to make sense. A cost reimbursement model, however, would take a look at the cost of delivering the letter R service to that child and reimbursing accordingly, and taking a look at the cost of that 2-to-1 student and reimbursing accordingly. And the numbers we have up here really talk about a current year reimbursement for salary and benefits, for contract expenses, for supplies and equipment, for excess cost for significant program growth, and for direct reimbursement for tuition for choice students. I've listened to Chamber of Commerce folks, as I sit on a regional Chamber of Commerce, talk about choice for special education, and I hear folks suggest that, you know, choice in the marketplace provides this competition, and competition tends to drive prices down. Choice in special education does exactly the opposite. It drives prices up. Because what ends up happening in a school district like my own is, if a parent comes to the table knowing we have a legal mandate to meet, but we try to meet that mandate in a more cost-effective fashion, they can pick the student up and go to another district, have that service delivered, and then the service is billed back to the home district.
That's really what happens under the choice programs. We're suggesting that students should have the opportunity to move under the choice option. But if the choice option is made available to the state of Minnesota, then the choice needs to be funded through the state of Minnesota as well. So in sum total, that is essentially what we're talking about in special education. The learner component then is really putting all of those things together. Counting students in a rational fashion as one each, making adjustments based on at-risk and ELL, multiplying that times a sufficient base, adding to that the current year cost of special education, and that's the district learner component.
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm your last director of the reimbursement on tuition for choice students. Doesn't that money follow the student as a choice?
Mr. Vandell.
Madam Chair, Representative, does the money follow the student? A student that chooses to go someplace else under open enrollment brings with them the foundation formula that the state provides. The student that chooses open enrollment and has a special need and is delivered special education services in that non-resident district has those expenses billed back. Now, in the past, districts have done direct billing one to another. On the current model, the State Department of Education is supposed to be sorting through the tuition billing and billing back accordingly. But it's a very convoluted structure, and it really does not lend to efficiency. I can talk real stories of programs that are in place in districts where a parent becomes upset at the way a program is being run and then chooses to pick their student up and go to the neighboring district, plunks them down there, and the District A has all of the infrastructure costs built in year one, staffed it all up, everything's their current year expense, and the student is gone in just a matter of weeks and goes to District B, and District B legally required to provide those services. How do I know that? The 2-to-1 student I just talked about is a student that knocked on her door last week from a neighboring school district. And we are in a situation where we're about to reduce $1.5 million out of our budget, but we are about to staff a legal mandate of a 2-to-1 ratio, two staff members to one student coming in the door from someplace else. Choice really comes at cost.
Mm-hmm. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair, and to my neighbor over here, comments. It's real complex, as you well. You really hit the nail on the head. One superintendent was in my office, and I paid out $20,000 last year, one of my neighboring districts. And then another one that didn't do the forms right and lost all of the money in special. But was discussion among you ever in regards to trying to track the students from the first grade on? There's a consortium of school districts, and I mentioned that in here, and I'm hoping to get a hearing, where some school districts have done very well. There's some pilot ones out there that have brought the numbers down. It's like from the statewide average, I think, is 13%, right, that are on there. And I believe that this particular consortium of school districts brought their number down from 13 in a matter of 4 years down to 8% by tracking and spending money on the students that were on the bubble at an early level. I think that's something we oftentimes overlay. Once you bring in that child, there's 14 different components, I think, to special ed. Once you do that, once you mark that child, you look at that child is still going to be in special ed on the average, on a high percentage, 5-6 years later. But again, I think that with the special ed, we could really, really make strides if we would do earlier tracking and pump a little more money in there, get the students out the bubble and get them up to where they are. But did you folks have a discussion in regards to that end of that piece?
Yeah.
Mr. Lundell.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, I believe you're talking about the response intervention being used in several consortia or several districts throughout the state. And it's something that was embraced heavily in the reauthorization of IDEA at the federal level, and I think that we're seeing a lot of interest by, you know, currently within the Department of Education here, but also among school districts to do exactly what you're saying. And it's to find those kids to you know, do interventions to get kids reading by, you know, second, third grade. And because what we have in special ed right now is really a failure-based system. And once kids fail, get behind, we need to, instead of having the kids kind of go over that special education wall, we need to intervene with kids early on, get them up to standards, keep them up to standards, and do that by intervening in the regular classroom as opposed to kind of having them go into special ed, because once they get there, as you've said, it doesn't really, many of the things may not augment, you know, solid learning in the long run.
Madam Chair, I would also like to continue forward. I want to make very clear. I am not suggesting that there should not be choice for special education students with special education families. I believe we're a district, we're a state that has embraced choice, and choice is here, and that's fine. Nor am I suggesting that what we should do is we should be looking to somehow restrict or minimize a special education investment for children with real needs. We need to take a look at what children, what inputs are required in order to get all children to the desired outcomes, and we need to fund that accordingly. And frankly, response to intervention that Mr. Lundell was just talking about is more easily accomplished in a school district outside of special education if the foundation is sufficient, if we have the resource in the standard program to meet the needs of most children. We probably don't need as large an investment, especially for the moderately needy children, through special education.
Representative Van Zels.
Madam Chair, and to the panel, what excuse me, what jumps out at me in trying to follow the last 8 or 9 minutes worth of very, very interesting and revealing dialogue is, how would you rate the State Department's level of technical assistance, staff development responsibilities, direction, supervision, that is provided to local boards of education and administrators who we give all these responsibilities to? And what made me ask the question was, in the discussion was, I'm paraphrasing now, somebody made a mistake somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a very good thing.
Mr. Vandell.
Madam Chair, Ms. Representative, I would suggest to you a couple of things. Sometimes you get what you wish for and you find out it wasn't a very good thing. And I represent an education community that has sometimes done battle with the Department of Education, and as a legislature you have as well. There were several years back that we almost took glee in cutting State Department budgets because that we needed to make sure money was targeted to the classroom as opposed to bureaucracy. In fact, what has happened is we have so reduced the resource going into what I would suggest is an essential department that we have stripped them of the kind of resource required to provide the kind of oversight you're suggesting. There are good people in the department. It's a good place run by well-intentioned individuals who have more serious resource restrictions than I think a lot of our schools have. And I'm not certain I had the maturity to say that 10 years ago, because I was one of those smiling, and that was the wrong thing to do.
Thank you for your candor.
Mm-hmm. Hey.
I'm going to move forward with the district instructional services. If you bought a kid as a kid and then there are kids, and you understand that a district is a district and then there are districts, we're going to talk about those districts right now. Because we really are talking about three different kinds of adjustments. Adjustments for school size, adjustments for location costs, and adjustments for enrollment decline. I mentioned my seminary years. As a facilitator for PS Minnesota, I felt like I've had to wear my marriage counselor hat. If I'd have been a priest, I'd have been doing a lot of this. Because I've got Scott Kernquist sitting side by side with Sam Walseth, and Brad would be there as well. But you know that you could triangulate these three gentlemen on almost any other occasion when you start talking about the kinds of things we're about to talk about. Because, you know, school size is an issue for Sam, and location cost is an issue for Scott, and in fact, these are issues for everyone. Understand the economy is a scale, arguments that need to be made. You recognize that it costs more to do business some places than others because of size. I'd love to maintain a 17-to-1 kindergarten class size ratio at Sauk Rapids Rice. I simply can't afford to do it. But I have one building where I occasionally run a 17-to-1. It's Rice Elementary. It's because once in a while I only have 34 kindergarten students, and so I have a choice at Rice Elementary of running 34-to-1 or 17-to-1, and I'll tell you, I'm going to run 17-to-1, even though I can't afford it. There are school districts that don't have choices in terms of
larger or smaller class sizes just based on their demographics. Rational systems account for that. And in fact, the research of APA would suggest that it's not just the smallest of the schools, but some of the largest of the schools have size considerations that need to be addressed as well. And there's a research base that you can tap and a formula that you can create that will account for this. You could also suggest that there are differences in the cost of doing business based on location. And because I was from Eden Valley for a long time and I like the alliterative property of Edina with Eden Valley, I'd make that comparison. When I was a teacher in Eden Valley, I was among the lowest paid teachers in the state of Minnesota. It's a small rural district, but I was among the better paid people in town. My standard of living was not too bad. I could live in a pretty good house and I did okay in Eden Valley. It's a small rural community and I was a professional. If I took the job in Edina, you know, where I would make truly the big bucks, I'm not sure I could make the case that I'd be one of the highest paid employees in town. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure if teachers can afford to live in Edina or some of the other high cost places. There's a difference in cost of doing business. And I made a dramatic example, and there are lots more refinements that need to be made in it, but you understand the concept that I can hire a bus driver in Eden Valley for a lot less than I can hire a bus driver in Edina. And a rational formula accounts for that. In fact, we're accounting for it currently, both the school size and the location costs, but you're accounting for it on the backs of property taxpayers through the operating referendum, and you really lay it before the will of the voters to make those differences be known. And some places don't have that will or don't have those means. We're suggesting that the system itself should account for that. And finally, the adjustment that needs to be made for enrollment decline. We don't have a levy in place because we've been growing. We've been spending our tax effort on buildings, but we've been growing, and that's given us new students. If we bring 100 new students in at $5,000 a kid, we've got $500,000, and we frankly don't necessarily hire 3 new teachers. What we do is we kind of sprinkle that money around, and we use our foundation to help us. Do you understand that? Think about it in the inverse. If we're losing 100 students and we lose $500,000, well, 100 students gone might be 3 or 4 teachers, but I'll tell you what, they don't cost $500,000. I lose a lot more in my total program. There needs to be a rational decline index. And while we have some of those indices in place, we would suggest they need to be refined. They need to be phased out over time. You shouldn't be spending on phantom students forever and always, but you should help a district step down from those capital and staffing obligations that they have based on numbers. Most schools in the state are in decline. These three factors, size, location, decline, really comprise the differences between districts, the primary differences.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the spirit of moving things along, we could get into a real good discussion on location, and I think we had those discussions the past couple of years. I'll just forego it. Thank you.
Oh, boy, I was looking forward to that. Just kidding. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to the testifier, because I've always been fascinated by this. In a world of limited resources, this comments about declining enrollment, you're asking us to pay school districts for students they don't have. And I just don't see anything rational about that. Would you like to comment on that?
Madam Chair and Mr. Representative, I would suggest to you in a rational school funding formula, a system designed for students in place to attain standards, you would not wish to have that school district fall off the cliff because of the loss of some students. So it would suggest instead of falling off the cliff that you begin to take them down the hill rather more slowly. I agree. It's not rational to fund forever. But nor is it rational to have a system predicated so solely on that foundation number that when the student is gone but the expense remains in place because it is more of a fixed cost, that the system has to fall apart as a result. Do you have a more complete response?
I pass.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dominguez.
I just got a question about the adjustment on enrollment decline. I know my school district, which is in Minneapolis, preparing for another decline of students. How do you adjust that so quick?
Mr. Van Dell.
Madam Chair, Representative Dominguez, you cannot adjust that quickly. That's the fundamental challenge.
That's the reason why we're advocating for a system that phases those students out over time, so you can phase those expenses out over time. That's precisely the reason why we're talking about doing it this way.
Just, Madam Chair, just to follow up, but we have classrooms that are 30, 40 students. How do we adjust to that?
Mr. Vandell.
Madam Chair, Representative Vigas, I'm not certain I understand the nature of the question with classrooms of 30 or 40 students. Are you suggesting that the result of the declining enrollment is classrooms of 30 or 40 students?
Yeah.
Okay, then my response would be that if the state would provide a sufficient base and then sufficiently step down the loss of students, the likelihood of needing to have classrooms of 40 students would be diminished.
And we have 80% of our districts in our state that are declining, and I've been here long enough, so I've heard some of the members, maybe not the same members, but some of the members representing the same districts who would ask Representative Garofalo's question, why are we paying for phantom students, but now they have declined enrollment, and those legislators aren't asking that anymore. So.
Madam Chair, very briefly, could we have Mr.
Representative Garofalo.
Could we have Mr. Strom, because we do have this in law right now where we do pay for students who aren't there using the AM CPUs. Could you just briefly cover that explanation? You do a better job than I would.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, under our current formulas, we use adjusted marginal cost pupil units as our main source of funding. And the marginal cost words of that formula mean that essentially we're using either the greater of your current year's enrollment or 77% of the current year's enrollment plus 23% of the previous year's enrollment. So it's essentially paying you for one of every four students that's left between the 2 years if you're in decline.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Graffel. I think that was helpful for all of us to hear. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that was what I was going to address. Thank you.
Thank you. Great minds think alike. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the impact, if I could get further clarification, so the impact of doing that is each year then paying for one of four? How does that phase in work?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilstrom, it's the 1 year essentially paying. So if you had a district with 104 kids in it last year and 100 in it this year, your enrollment for this year would count as 101 kids. One of those four who left, essentially you're counting for the next year. And then for following years, you measure the distance between the new year and the one just prior to it. So if four kids left between year one and year two, and between year two and three, if no kids left, then you'd be back to zero on the number of declining kids you're paying for. So under the current formula, it's essentially a 1 year opportunity, and you pick up 23% of the loss, which is just about one of every four kids.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Oh, Mr. Vandell.
Madam Chair, I would return to the analogy I used at the beginning. I talked about the quilt. This is a piece of the quilt that you have in place. Whether you have it in place sufficiently or not, I think is subject to total examination, how it fits with everything else. We're pleased that some mechanism exists, and we're suggesting that the reconstruction of this formula certainly needs to have that be the case as well. I'm going to move to district support services. District support services is the kind of infrastructure costs that all districts have that currently are not addressed. I'll suggest to you this first one, deferred maintenance and capital facility revenues. This is the classic conflict that takes place every spring in a school district. We have X number of dollars that are capital outlay. And for capital outlay dollars, we compete with textbooks, computers, and roofs. Those three categories compete one to another. Once in a while, we can buy some textbooks. Once in a while, we can buy some computers. And once in a while, we can do some roofs. And frankly, you can almost never do what you need in either of them. It's a result of these needs competing one with another for a limited base. This is where we're going to rely on the work of our Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, MASBO, who has done some research as a part of our coalition and has found some pretty solid data which would suggest that in private industry, if you suggest that the total infrastructure, physical plant costs of a company are 100%, 2% of that cost should be reinvested annually in upkeep of the facility if you really do want a life cycle that is reasonable. reasonable. We don't have anywhere near that kind of an investment in Minnesota, and we're advocating for a system that would have a deferred maintenance and capital facility revenue that would be tied to that. We'd also argue that there should be a separate technology revenue that funds both student technology needs and, as importantly, system technology needs. And I would suggest to you that if you look at student needs, the cost of a Wintel machine in Bowabic is not so much different from Bemidji or from Buffalo. But if you talk about connectivity, the system access, it's different in different parts of the state, and that a rational system would address those connectivity costs. That would be something we would advocate. We'd also advocate for a transportation revenue system, and we're going to get to this, that is like... in concept, like our special education, it's a real cost, current year kind of formulation. We'll talk about that in a short time. And finally, we could call this integration. We call it desegregation. While we've got it in this category of support services, in fact, we probably could have dropped it back into the other category. We had debates about that, about differences between districts. Regardless of where you place it, we know we need to address the issues of desegregation. Finally in this, we would suggest that this the state system of funding by pilot program, while intriguing, really is very, very frustrating for this school districts in the state of Minnesota. If the state is going to sponsor an initiative, if that initiative is of statewide import, then I would suggest that you make the funding for that system universally available and make sure it's fully funded along the way. The transportation elements we're talking about really start with the state definition of what it is we want us to do. Do you want us to bring kids who are under a mile in? What are the standards associated with that? What adjustments need to be made for sparsity? We recognize that sparsity does have to be addressed. It's the one place we address sparsity specifically in our construct at this point in time, not back in the student component, but really under the transportation expenses. Sparsity under the student component really is addressed currently under the small school size adjustment. We believe that we need to fund fully between building and district special education expenses, and currently those sit in the special ed category and compete with instructional dollars. We need to move them into transportation dollars. Hazardous transportation, folks have stumbled over that. What does it mean, hazardous transportation? What it means is that there are hazardous conditions that exist in districts, and we need to account for those conditions. If kids have to walk across railroad tracks, even if they're a block from school, we need to talk about picking them up rather than having them go across hazardous crossings. We need energy price relief, and we also need a system that permits districts acquisition capabilities. They can purchase fleets, and perhaps even some green fleet incentives that go along with this. Transportation dollars currently compete with educational dollars, with instructional dollars. I'll suggest to you, I know almost exactly when the Senate and the House decided they were going to roll transportation into the general fund, because that was the year that at the bargaining table, my teacher team turned to me and said, "We're really concerned about the high cost of transportation in the Sauk Rapids Rice District." And I thanked them for their concern, and I knew that their concern wasn't purely vested in the efficiencies of transportation. It was because those dollars were suddenly available in the marketplace. I would suggest that the marketplace should be getting kids to and from school, and that we need to make sure that they're restricted to that use.
I agree.
District support services, then, is... support services funding is maintenance funding, technology funding, transportation funding, DSEG funding, and any targeted initiatives. So what are we talking about? We're talking about a concept that pulls all of these elements together. Count the students, you make the adjustments, you multiply that times a sufficient base. You add special education to it. You add district instructional services and district support services. And essentially what you've done is, if you've rationally determine the costs associated with it, use some research base in establishing those numbers, you've put a system in place that should give most people the opportunity to meet the standards. We're not prescribing how that's done. There's a lot of local control associated with this. Districts still get to decide the mechanism of delivery, but they have sufficient resources. But we know we're in an environment where meeting the standards might not be enough because communities value things differently. In Eden Valley, the value might be to maintain the 1-17 ratio in kindergarten, first, and second grade, even though the state really probably can't afford that universally across the whole state, whether we like it or not. So in Eden Valley, you provide the board discretion to say, hey, this is important to us. We're going to raise some taxes here at our own discretion, and we're going to put it for something that goes beyond the base program. In Edina, the Dynamite Value Total Immersion Program for Mandarin Chinese. And while the state might say, you know, that's really not within our core mission for all kids all the time, Edina might want to do that, so we provide Edina the opportunity to target that resource with voter discretion at moving beyond the basics. We'd also suggest that that discretion needs to be equalized and it needs to be limited. The research would suggest about 20%, but we're not here to advocate that number. We're simply here to say that it needs to be limited. And we also know that if you're moving beyond the basics, that needs to be equalized access to facilities construction. Whenever we use the word equalized, we recognize that that means state investment. And if there's a state investment and the state has some skin in the game, they have a responsibility to have sustainability standards. I don't think it's wise for states to invest in infrastructures that don't necessarily meet viability standards. I think that you can adopt those kinds of viability standards. Reasonable people will be able to figure that out. So where are we going from here? We're engaged in these policymaker discussions. We've got a coalition of about 19 partners and growing right now. We're a group of individuals that, while we might have our own unique causes and concerns, and these three gentlemen and their 16 counterparts will be here advocating different things, this is one time when you're going to see them on the same page about some pretty fundamental concepts. That's very, very important. We've got a research base behind us using probably the most well-respected national outfit that's out there. We have a framework that we believe is responsive to differences. We've got a reform initiative that we think is targeted to student achievement of state standards. And we believe that this system is designed for the greater good. We, in fact, will be back before you because we're busy drafting a bill right now. And as the representative said a little bit earlier, while we want you to adopt this wholesale and fully fund it at this moment in time, the real world would suggest that it will take a transition. And the transition is going to be a part of our bill. We're going to focus initially on special education. We're going to be talking about establishing what we believe is a more rational base, and we're going to try to get you over a six-year, five-year period of time to phase toward that. And there are several other component parts that will be brought forward in that draft bill. So this is a lot to swallow and probably something that one would say, well, not only is it a lot to swallow, but I just don't know if it's appetizing to me at this stage of the game. We're going to try to feed it to you, hopefully over the course of time, in chunks that do in fact seem to make sense, but our target is a total reformation of the system. Very, very thankful that you've given us very quality time here. We'd be happy to respond to any other questions that you might have and stand ready to serve as resources for you all along the way.
Thank you very much. You've given us a lot of food for thought here today as well. And before we go to final questions, do any of the other three of you have any closing comments you want to make? Okay.
I've taken most of the air out of the room, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, very much. We have Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I read the C report, very good report. And I like the idea, and I think your first initiative is eliminating the referendum. I mean, getting rid of that. I mean, we've got, I know there's a good number of us running around with various bills having to do with debt equalization, trying to go back to the old one tax reform bill, and trying to, if we could even get back to where the state made a promise where they're going to fund education to 100%. And I think we're as high as 88%. We've eliminated some of the property, some of these shifts. We still have the property tax recognition shift, but there's a number of things, but I like the idea. Now I've got Representative Marquardt sitting here, and he is the chair of the property tax division. It'd be nice now if we could get a property tax reform to get Representative Bradley our money that we need and to get the entire state of Minnesota to fund each kid equally. Anybody from Edina here? No, I didn't mean that, but anyways. But anyways, with that said, I really appreciate the report. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Heidgerken. Representative Benson.
I am from Edina, or at least I taught in Edina for 35 years, and your comments about Edina make sense. In fact, all your comments made sense to me, and after having spent a career in education, the idea of funding things based on the student need, instead of this Byzantine system that I've discovered in the last 3 weeks of being here, is very, very refreshing. And I just didn't find working in Edina gave me a lot more money to live on than a school district you were talking about. So thank you very much. I found this very rewarding. I've been following PS Minnesota very closely, and you're on the right track.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. Madam Chair, I would agree with Representative Benson and my in general overall comments. I just have one question, though. It seems like you've taken a lot of characteristics into account, and it led me to the question as is. Do you think a model like this really prepares our children to compete successfully in the 21st century? And then I quickly looked back to your opening statement, and the answer was yes. And then, so that led me to the next question, and that is, do you think that a truly gifted and talented, child can be sufficiently educated under this model? Mr. Vandell.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would say my response is going to be very similar on both points. The research would suggest that if you sufficiently fund the foundation to meet the standards and you allow the organization to make the determination of how best to deliver those standards, there is room to run a very vibrant, gifted, and talented program. So that's part of the reason why you don't see a special category for special education here. For gifted and talented. Typically, that special category emerges when there isn't a sufficiency of resource. And so an interest group rises up and says, we need to carve out and capture something specifically for that. Well, gifted and talented, high achievement programs might look different in different places. There's room in a sufficiently funded formula to make that happen. As to whether or not we can compete in the 21st century, I would suggest to you that this formulation is tied into what you expect of us. And if you think that the expectation needs to be raised, then what does this formulation do? It raises the amount of money you need to invest. Why? Because it's an inputs-driven system. If you raise the standards, you're really raising the cost of doing business, and so it needs to be funded in accordance with that. So I would argue this system will meet whatever set of standards you wish to lay in front of us. And I'll suggest to you that Minnesota's educators stand ready to meet whatever test you've laid before us.
Just to add to that, I think that we've seen it with gift and talent in the state. I think that, you know, it was once in the formula and it was out of the formula, then it kind of crept back in where districts are doing plan, and now we're back to where it's categorical per district. I look at it as an access question, and things probably is partling both in what each student needs, but then what each system needs as well. Because I think when you talk about it, you know, vocational programming, while of a different, there may be gifted and talented kids in vocational, so I'm not going in that direction, but it causes some level of system change to make sure there's access to kids for a certain type of education. And I think that we may need to look at that in gifted and talented as well, as what does the system need statewide to make sure that every gifted and talented child, or those identified, or those so motivated, have access to those types of programs. And I think what ANOCA's done with secondary vocational and STEP programs, you know, may not be something that's automatically transferable into that realm. I think there are ways we have to look at this both from the student and what the student needs and what the system needs to be able to provide that.
We have Representative Olson, Representative Demmer, and Representative Garofalo, and so we'll hope to get to those three. Nobody else, I think, needs to bother to add their name to the list. Representative Olson.
I'll be brief, Madam Chair. Mr. Vandell, if I understand correctly from Representative Heidkirchen's comments, the proposal that you're talking about is to eliminate any kind of local discretionary referendum? No? I'm begging your pardon if I missed that. Could you clarify that for me, please?
Mr. Vandell.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Olson. What we're trying to do is to eliminate the reliance of local school districts on the operating referendum to deliver the basic program. What we're trying to suggest is that a good system gives local voter discretion, but it truly is for extra things, not for the base program. I shouldn't have to ask my voters for more money so that I can offer elementary classes of 25 to 1. And I'm going to have to do that next November because they're going to be 35 to 1 otherwise. And what we're saying is that's unconscionable. It's not the system that should be in place. We should be funding the standards sufficiently so that extra effort goes for extra program.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Rep. Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I applaud the work that you're doing. I've been, it's my fifth year here. I spent 5 years on the school board, and I've always thought that a comprehensive look at how we fund education is needed. I've always said that, however, with the caveat that the system we have has evolved over time based on input and direction and the best intentions of a lot of good and probably smarter people than me. So I've always used that as a caveat by not saying that it's a totally stupid system, so to speak. So having that as a background, first a comment and then maybe just a quick question. You made a lot of reference to private industry and business. And, of course, all along the way, I felt like I needed to be responding all along because that's what I am as a private businessman. I'm not a teacher. I'm not a school administrator. I own and operate private businesses the last 25 years, and so lots of things I could draw comparisons to, and I could debate some of those with you, if you will. But I'm pleased to hear that because oftentimes I hear when I try to bring those things in, people say, this isn't for business. This is about kids. This isn't about widgets. And now you're bringing a lot of those kind of characteristics back in again, which... And some of them don't apply, some do apply.
Mm-hmm.
There are some very fundamental differences when we do some comparisons on both sides of that, and I look forward to the debate as time goes on, as we look at this on a piece-by-piece basis. I did happen to notice, though, in the people on the PS Minnesota, there are no business people represented here, and you spent a lot of time comparing to business and using those analogies. Was there any thought given to actually having business people involved in your conversations as you constructed this and use those analogies to see how well they applied or don't apply?
Mr. Vandell.
Madam Chair, Representative, we in fact have engaged in conversations with businesses over the course of time, but this is no doubt an education coalition. We've had considerable feedback from business community, and I don't know that we would need to debate, you and I, on the differences between business and education. I think we would probably find more points of agreement than disagreement because we run our own kinds of businesses. There's one fundamental difference between private industry and public education. And in some fashion, private industry is based a bit on a survival of the fittest mentality. It's competition. But public education is premised on the greatest good for the greatest number. And sometimes those things clash. And so that's where we probably would find that there might be differences in our approach. I would really endorse the opportunity to sit down more fully. We've extended invitations, so to speak, out to some of the business organizations in the state. They've certainly sat through some of our presentations and provided feedback. We need to be informed by that work.
Thank you. And our time is up, but Representative Garofalo said he was really short, so I'm going to count on that. Representative Garofalo.
I don't want to... Just disagree with my highly respected colleague, Representative Heidegger, but my understanding is that the property tax recognition shift has been paid off. And maybe staff would just clear me up on that.
Well, when we discussed that, and he might be referring to the 90-10 that you just talked about before. But in any case, the time is up. You two can continue that.
Thank you so much.